You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get the latest on a Wisconsin case involving new DNA evidence that recently went back to court. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Yesterday, Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman announced that he will not run for a second term next year. Gableman has served on the court now for 9 years. Robert Metzer joins us for the details of that and other top news from over the last week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, and he's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. It's good to be back.
So Supreme Court justices have this 10-year term here in Wisconsin. They are elected. Justice Gableman, an incumbent. A couple people had lined up to race against him. Now they won't. He's not going to run again.
Yes. Gableman's election in 2008 was one of the most partisan, one of the most hotly contested, and really one of the ugliest Wisconsin Supreme Court elections. He managed to pull off a defeat of Justice Lewis Butler, who had been the state's first African-American justice. And it was the first time that an incumbent justice had been defeated in decades and decades. That happened after Gableman blanketed the airwaves with some very misleading claims involving Butler's work as a public defender. That led to a whole ethics complaint that was eventually dismissed by the Supreme Court, which deadlocked on it. So there would have been, you know, starting out as a, you know, in a campaign, I'm sure that all of these things would have been topics of discussion, and he would have had to go around the state answering these questions about that 10-year-old controversy. Who knows? I don't know what's in the guy's heart. There's probably a lot of reasons not to run for re-election, but I wonder if that wasn't a one factor.
And he's going to serve out his whole term, it sounds like. Sometimes there's the idea that if you know now, you resign early, maybe somebody can get appointed in advance. From his announcement anyway, plans to serve out the whole term.
Sure. So Gableman, I mean, understand Gableman as he's a conservative justice, and he's also a politically conservative guy. The candidates who have announced that they are running are both very much, you know, sort of on the liberal side of things. They both spoke at the state Democratic Party convention, for example. And so we just this morning had the announcement of another conservative who will seek the seat. But this, you know, at the least, this does give conservatives, sufficient time to field a candidate, though that candidate will not come with the name justice in front of their name, but probably a judge seeking to be elevated.
And, of course, the Supreme Court race is a nonpartisan race. They don't run under a party label. But nonpartisan is really pretty much in quotes, right? There are always Republican and conservative-backed candidates on one side and Democratic/liberal candidates on the other, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like we would go through this every couple weeks, you know. I mean, yeah, they're nonpartisan, but who are they kidding? I don't know if it was always like this. I think that this may be in some ways an artifact of just sort of increasing political polarization in Wisconsin and in our nation. But at this point, it seems like it's just the barest fig leaf by which anyone even pretends not to be have a partisan affiliation. I don't, you know, there's legitimately are different judicial philosophies. People have different, you know, bring different ideas about what is appropriate, you know, interpretation of law, and so that's, you know, that is sort of fair enough as far as it goes. But yeah, I mean, in 2017, those seem to split quite cleanly along partisan lines.
We're talking to Rob Metzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, talking about some of the top Wisconsin news stories of the day. Let's move on. Now, President Trump visited the state on Tuesday. He was in Milwaukee. As part of that, he alluded to maybe many manufacturing jobs coming to Wisconsin. And now we're hearing rumblings about this company, Foxconn, from, I think, Hong Kong, looking at Wisconsin to build phones. What do we know about this?
Right. Well, I mean, we know that that there is no announcement. I know it will come as a shock to listeners that that the president may possibly have released some information that wasn't quite ready to be released. But as shocking as that is, that seems to be what has happened. But the day after, so Trump was in town. He talked about a very happy surprise very soon. The day after, the Associated Press was able to track down what it was that he was talking about. And it's Foxconn. So in January, this giant company, they manufacture iPhones and iPads, and other electronic devices for Sony, for other brands. They have, they employ about 1 million people in China, so it's a big company. In January, this company, Foxconn, had said that it is considering investing $7 billion in a U.S. factory that will produce display panels and will employ as many as 50,000 people. So that is the size of a small city. So, it's a very big deal. The thing is, it does not seem to be clear that that Wisconsin is going to end up being the site. That Foxconn had said they were looking at sites in Pennsylvania. The AP tracked down the fact that both Governor Scott Walker and Michigan Governor Rick Snyder this month had made visits to Japan, where the Taiwanese company also has offices. Appears, and maybe not. Maybe it's further along than what has been made public. But it appears that that there's some competition going on about who can provide the best sites and the best incentive packages for what would indeed be a very, very significant economic boost.
Yeah, I looked online, Rob. 50,000 would be the 13th largest city in Wisconsin, just edging out Sheboygan. This would be, if it was one plant really employing 50,000, that would be huge.
No doubt. A range of different jobs, right? And sometimes these things, I haven't studied the details myself. Sometimes there's a little bit of fuzzy math here. It would create 50,000 jobs.
Right. Does that mean, are they working directly in the factory or?
Right. There's sort of supply chain questions or whatever. But I mean, no way around it. It's a massive project. It would be a big deal.
But Foxconn has seen some controversy over the years for its factories mainly in China over human rights, worker suicides on plants, so they don't come without some baggage.
No doubt, they certainly have been, and there have been cases about workers exposed to harmful chemicals. In China, it is the norm that you know workers sort of live on campus and maybe. Far away from their homes and work in this factory in these sort of crushing conditions. It sounds horrible. It is not our American conception of a good life. Obviously an American plan is subject to American labor standards. I don't know that it would be quite so dire, but. It's a factory job there, and I think that the expectations and the pace may be fairly challenging.
I want to move on to one story at the national level now. The Republican health care bill has been in the news. Some senators working in private to draft this. We've heard Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican, made some comments about that earlier this week. What did he say?
Yes, so. Ron Johnson is part of the 13-member working group in the U.S. Senate that is supposed to be drafting the Republican health care bill, which, according to reports, they are hoping to pass this month before the July 4th recess. So Johnson was asked by a Bloomberg reporter whether he had seen the bill. He said he had not. The reporter asked if that concerned him, and he said yes. He later followed up, Johnson did, with a statement to the Wisconsin State Journal that said, quote, "This is incredibly complex, and from my standpoint, I will need a whole lot more information before I agree to vote yes on a bill." But what this really underscores is just how secretive the process of writing the bill has been. Johnson has made his whole career, his whole political political career on opposition to Obamacare, and he has repeatedly called it the greatest threat to freedom in our lifetime. I have not seen any political analyst who says that his vote is sort of up for grabs or that he is likely to vote no. He's very likely to vote for the bill. And still, the Republican leadership has not let him see the bill.
We'll leave it there for now. Rob, thanks for joining us, as always.
All right. Thank you.
That's Robert Menzer with USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday to take a look back at some of the state's biggest news of the week. Richard Baranek was convicted of rape in 1990 and has served 27 years of the 243-year term that he was given. But just last week, a Dane County judge overturned the sexual assault conviction based on new examination of DNA evidence that had been used to convict him, of physical evidence that had been originally used to convict him. Jarrett Adams is one of Mr. Baranek's defense lawyers. He's an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York, was once exonerated himself on a wrongful conviction. Jarrett, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, remind us of the details. We've talked about this a little before, of Richard Baranek's case.
So, Mr. Baranek, he was convicted of a 1988 sexual assault. The victim was someone broke into her home. They assaulted her. And when they assaulted her, she called the police. She let the police do the investigation. The police collected a number of items. They collected bed sheets and things like that. And so there was evidence collected. There was a hair found in a pair of underwear that was presumably left by the perpetrator. And in fact, that's exactly what, the prosecution said in their case, that the underwear was left by the perpetrator. They had an FBI analyst, and this is the key to the case and why it was overturned. They had an FBI analyst get on the stand and testify that under a microscope, he viewed a hair of Mr. Baranek's and also the hair that was recovered from the perpetrator's underwear. And he said that those hairs look consistent, and the jury believed that. They believe that, faced with Mr. Baranek's defense of six alibi witnesses that included family members as well as people that he did work for in a different state. And they all said that Mr. Baranek was in that state during the time of this assault. Mr. Baranek was picked out of a photo lineup first 2 years after the assault. And he was charged, and he was brought to trial based on nothing but the identification of the victim 2 years later. So when the jury is looking at this evidence, and they're listening to the evidence, and they're listening to the identification by the witness, and then they're listening to Mr. Baranek and his six witnesses say, look, he's not in this state, the tiebreaker is what? It's the FBI agent getting on the stand saying, look, I looked at this hair, and this hair is consistent with Mr. Baranek's hair. So it is reasonable to believe that the jury convicted him based off of this hair. Years later, we did DNA testing on the hair, and the hair came back to exclude Mr. Baranek as not the contributor of that hair. So we litigated and we litigated and we litigated. And finally, on June 9th, Dane County Court Judge Moser overturned the conviction based just on that the FBI's agent's testimony was knowingly false. After, I must add, that there was letters that were issued by the FBI brass saying that testimony of this kind was not to be used anymore. That letter came out in, I want to say, 1992 or 93 is when these letters started to come out, and they were instructed not to testify in this manner anymore. But it still took years and years of litigation to get Richard Baranek a new trial.
Now, this challenge came from the Wisconsin Innocence Project and you from the New York Innocence Project. What was it that clued in lawyers on the Innocence Project that this was a case worth reviewing?
Well, it's a number of things. You know, when you have a sexual assault, you have the opportunity for the perpetrator to leave behind some type of DNA. Because of the advancements of DNA over time, it has gotten better, and testing has gotten significantly better. And because of the fact that there were six witnesses who testified that Mr. Baranek was in a different state at the time, and the only thing tying them to the crime was a two-year-old identification, we felt it was worth the resources to investigate this case and find out one way or another. The Innocence Project, we don't go in and just say, all right, well, you say you're innocent, so we're going to go with that. We go in and we also reach out to the opposing side, the prosecutor, and we say, hey, look, let's just test this evidence to make sure that we got it right. And so that's exactly what we did in this case. And come to find out, they got it wrong.
What does it take to get the prosecutors or judges involved to say, yeah, let's take that evidence back out and use our most modern science to see what we've really got here?
Well, it's extremely difficult because first, it would be a lot easier if a prosecutor would agree and say, okay, let's just go ahead and test it. If they don't agree to testing, then we have to litigate it. And there are laws in Wisconsin, in each state actually, that allow a person to meet a certain standard. If you can meet the certain standard, the eye test, where you're saying, look, no physical evidence was ever connected to my client in this case, and the case rested simply on an eyewitness identification, which through years of research has now proven that eyewitness identification is one of the most unreliable pieces of evidence that is used in criminal convictions. People get it wrong. When you're under pressure, like someone is attacking you and your heart is racing, you get it wrong sometimes. We're people.
Do you ever hear from prosecutors the concern when you review these cases that once this DNA is retested, they found out they got it wrong, that the actual perpetrator was never caught, never charged?
And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's what this is all about. This is about getting in right and really making a community safe. And you can't say that you swear to do the duty of the court and protect the community and put all bad guys in prison, and then when you're faced with evidence that suggests their innocence, you don't investigate it thoroughly and fully to make sure that the community is really safe. And so it's one of these things where we find ourselves pitting ourselves against each other in the criminal justice system, where each side just wants to win. Instead of doing that, we need to focus our energy on how do we get to justice, not just winning.
Talking to Jarrett Adams. He's with the Innocence Project in New York, one of the defense lawyers for Richard Baranek. Just had his conviction overturned, an older conviction, 27 years into his sentence of a 243-year sentence based on DNA testing of physical evidence from that case. So now what for Richard Baranek? Where is he? What happens next?
Well, now he has just been, his conviction is vacated, so he's just been transferred to the Dane County Jail. And now what we're doing is the posture of the case is that we are trying to litigate for bond pending the resolution of what the state decides to do. They have the opportunity to retry him or dismiss the case, but they have a time limit in which they can do it. And so in between time, we want to argue that our client is released to his family, and you know, the state can decide whether or not they're going to retry him. And essentially what happens is this, to make it understandable. When a conviction is vacated and reversed, it goes back to its beginning stages. And the beginning stages are he's simply charged with the crime, and he is supposed to be innocent until proven guilty.
But that doesn't mean he walks free the moment the judge says that conviction is overturned.
No, unfortunately, it doesn't. There's a lot of things that won't allow for a person to just walk free. But there are some circumstances where a judge can rule and a guy is just released outright, and it doesn't challenge. A lot of those times comes when a prosecutor is willing to jointly agree to just, you know, do it all at one time and dismiss the charges. In this case, we didn't get that, and we don't fault the other side or question the other side. We just represent Mr. Baranek. We hope to have a bail hearing next week to see that he's home, and we hope that the resolution of this case is fully dismissed soon.
Supposing that the prosecutor decides to dismiss the case, or it goes to a new trial and he's found not guilty, is there some kind of compensation for the years in prison if he's found to have been wrongfully convicted?
Well, let me make sure that I make this clear for all the listeners that are listening right now. There is a compensation issue in Wisconsin, period. They are one of the lowest states in terms of compensation. It's 25 years max, no matter how many years you've spent in prison. With that being said, even if it was $1 million for each year you spent in prison, financially you're compensated, but Mr. Baranek can never be compensated for the years that he missed watching his daughter grow. He will still be able to go home, look in his photo album, and it will stop at the day that he was arrested, and it will not begin until 27 years later.
You talked earlier about the problems with hair sample analysis from the FBI. This is something, as I understand it, that is not a problem anymore, because if you have this hair evidence, you go right to the DNA test. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. It's one of the – I'll say this. There are certain tests that are advancing right now that allow us to test the hair, mitochondrial DNA, to test the hair, to be able to compare it and see if it excludes someone or if it is a perfect match. But you know, the science is science. It's advancing. It's not 100%, and it's still moving in a new area. It's not the same as saliva or blood or something like that. It's still being developed, but right now it's accurate enough to exclude a person in the manner in which it did with Mr. Baranek's case. And, you know, I just feel as if we really need to trust our science. If we can trust the advancements of a society with phones and cameras and buildings and structures, we should accept the science and clean up our criminal convictions. And if you think about it, yeah, it stops people from being wrongfully convicted at this point. But what about the other people who were convicted on the same DNA evidence that we didn't have? They were convicted on this hair analysis by FBI agents. What about them?
Are you still looking for those people?
We absolutely are. It is a daunting task. It's very difficult. In a lot of these cases, the evidence just isn't there to test. It's destroyed at some times. You know, the preservation laws in states, in a lot of states, were implemented after guys were convicted. And so in some cases where you got convictions back in the 1980s, you know, some people's evidence has been destroyed or lost. And at that point, you have nothing to test.
Jared, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
That was Jared Adams. He's an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York. He was part of the team that just won a new trial for Wisconsin's Richard Baranek, whose conviction was overturned because of DNA evidence. President Donald Trump announced that he is canceling President Obama's policy toward Cuba today, fulfilling a promise he made on the campaign trail. The policy was announced in Little Havana, Florida, and will change travel restrictions and reinstate the 56-year-old trade embargo. Here's a listen.
We will enforce the ban on tourism. We will enforce the embargo. We will take concrete steps to ensure that investments flow directly to the people so they can open private businesses and begin to build their country's great, great future, a country of great potential.
The move is expected to have foreign policy and economic impacts for the U.S., and even though President Obama's decision to open up relations with Cuba wasn't initially popular with Republicans, many of them have been working toward more open relations with the country. William Leo Grand joins us now. He's a professor of government at American University and a specialist in U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. William, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, now, compare what we're seeing from President Trump today to what happened, what was going on with the embargo before President Obama's changes.
Well, the changes that President Trump announced today do not take us all the way back to the time before December 17th, 2014, when President Obama and President Raul Castro announced that they wanted to normalize relations. What President Trump announced today hits at two very specific kinds of business between Cuba and the United States. It prohibits Americans from going to Cuba on people-to-people educational travel by themselves or on their own as individuals. You have to go with an organized group now. And that's a return to what policy was since the Clinton administration. The other thing that they've done is to prohibit any transactions with a Cuban business that's managed by a company that reports to the armed forces, or is it part of the Ministry of the Armed Forces. That's important because about half the Cuban tourist industry is in enterprises that are managed by the armed forces. What will happen next is the State Department will put out a list of the companies that you can't do business with. And this is going to, I think, put a chill on travel to the island Because if I'm, if I'm visiting Cuba and I stop in a corner store to buy a bottle of water, and that corner store happens to be part of an enterprise that's managed by the armed forces, I could be breaking the U.S. embargo inadvertently and be subject to fines.
We'll get into the impact on Cuba in just a bit. How much of a difference does this make, say, economically and foreign policy-wise for the United States?
Well, it's going to restrict U.S. businesses' ability to work with some Cuban enterprises. It's not entirely clear until we see the details of the regulations just how extensive that will be. They are carving out some exceptions, important exceptions to these regulations, although the Cuban military does run the ports and the airports and telecommunications. Those three areas have been exempted from this, and of course, that's the area right now where most U.S. businesses are operating. It's the cruise ships going into ports, it's the airliners flying into airports, and it's several different U.S. telecom companies doing business to expand Internet access on the island.
The president talked a lot today about freedoms in Cuba and lack of same and human rights issues. Here's a listen.
We will not lift sanctions on the Cuban regime until all political prisoners are freed. Freedoms of assembly and expression are respected. All political parties are legalized. And free and internationally supervised elections are scheduled.
So, in effect, economic leverage here to promote human rights and political freedoms in Cuba. Is this something that could be an effective policy?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is a policy the United States has been following since 1960, of trying to use economic coercion to get the Cuban government to behave the way we want them to behave, and it has never worked. That's the principal reason that President Obama changed the policy back in 2014. The Cubans are very sensitive about their nationalism, their national sovereignty. They spent the better part of the first half of the 20th century as a kind of quasi-colony of the United States. And so when any foreign power, but especially the United States, starts telling them what to do and how to organize their affairs, they react very badly.
Talking to William Leo Grand from American University, looking at President Trump's announcement today changing the United States' Cuba policy. Let's talk a little more, though, about human rights in Cuba. President Trump, again, focused on that a lot. It is not necessarily a happy picture, is it?
No, the Cuban government does not tolerate dissidents. When dissidents go out to demonstrate or organize a meeting, the police typically arrest them and break up their demonstrations and break up their meetings. There is greater space for political debate in Cuba today, partly as a result of the expansion of the Internet. There's a very robust set of blogs which run the gamut from government supporters to open dissidents like Yoani Sanchez. There is an increasing number of digital journalists who are running really digital news services. So there's actually a lot going on besides just the traditional dissidents who demonstrate against the regime and get arrested. But I must say, I think the invocation of human rights as the reason for this policy change is really pretty cynical on the part of the administration. This is a president who went to Saudi Arabia and said he wasn't going to tell the Saudis how to run their lives. A president who applauded the president of the Philippines, who is engaging in a campaign of extrajudicial executions of suspected drug users. He approved the Turkish referendum tearing down democratic institutions, and he's never had a bad thing to say about President Putin in Russia. So this is not an administration that has ever put human rights at the forefront of American policy. So I think to do it now, in the case of Cuba, is really more an excuse than it is a reason.
If not human rights, what do you think is the reason for this change?
I think this is a policy dictated by domestic politics. You just have to look at the venue where the president made this speech, in Manuel Artime Theater, named after the leader of the Cuban exile Bay of Pigs invasion. He said as much in the speech himself, when he thanked the Cuban-American conservatives for having voted for him and said that he had come to redeem his campaign promise to reverse Obama's policy.
William Leo Grand is with us. He's a professor at American University. He specializes in U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. You can join the conversation now about President Trump's policy announcement on Cuba, tightening some things that have been opened up under the Obama administration. Call in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. should revive the longstanding embargo with Cuba? Do you think the Obama-era policy towards Cuba should stay? What about travel? Do you think the United States should restrict individual travel, person-to-person travel, as it's sometimes called? If you're a member of the business community, how do you see this affecting you? Are you from Cuba? Is your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm picking up the conversation now with William Leo Grand, professor at American University, specialist in U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. We're talking about President Trump's announced changes in U.S.-Cuba policy, what it can mean, looking at the idea of maybe not completely going back to the days of the full-on embargo, but definitely moving in that direction. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you see these policy changes affecting you or your family personally? Do you think the new policy will help or hurt the U.S.? Do you think it's a good idea? Is it good leverage potentially on human rights in Cuba? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Abraham joins us in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. You know, I wanted to say that this change of policy doesn't really do anything besides, act as a, smoke play of the media than anything else. This is the same president that is complicit in many ways in human rights abuses across the world, from Saudi Arabia to Indonesia and many other places, as was rightfully pointed out by your guest. It really isn't anything but just a play of the media and perhaps even a distraction away from what the president is experiencing, politically speaking, at the moment.
Abraham, thanks for the call. William, he agrees with you about human rights here. Did you see, William, benefits from President Obama's policy in terms of changes in Cuba?
Yes, I think so. I think the reason that we've seen a tremendous expansion of Internet access is precisely because that was one of the things that President Obama negotiated, or his team negotiated back in 2014. As part of the agreement of December 17th, the Cubans agreed to expand Internet access, and since that time, a number of U.S. companies have been able to go in there and sign contracts with the Cuban telecommunications firm to actually begin to put that into practice. So now you have Wi-Fi spots that are expanding across the island, and I think that's very beneficial. As I said, the most robust debate right now in Cuba is happening online.
And I've seen reports that in the U.S. Senate, we have something like 55 senators signed on to a plan to loosen relations with Cuba still further, reduce the embargo more, including Democrats and some Republicans. Is politics moving in a different direction than the president here?
I think Congress is moving in a different direction. The 55 senators co-sponsoring Senator Flake's bill, the Freedom to Travel bill, and what it would do is repeal all restrictions on travel to Cuba. And the basic principle there is that Americans have a constitutional right to travel, and the government shouldn't be telling us where we can and can't go unless there's really an overriding national security interest, which clearly doesn't exist in the Cuban case. Over in the House of Representatives, you've got a number of conservative Republican members of Congress who are working hard to expand trade with Cuba. Congressman Crawford, Congressman Emmer, have both been working very hard and lobbying the White House to allow an expansion of agricultural sales and to begin to remove the embargo itself. So it's a bipartisan issue in Congress. To be sure, there are still members who are in favor of maintaining the embargo, and they tend to be the most conservative Republicans. But there are a lot of Republicans who are responding to their business constituencies who want to open up the Cuban market.
We're talking to William Leo Grand from American University about President Trump's announcement today on U.S. policy toward Cuba. Back to your calls now with David on the line in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
So, yeah, I just had a question. Since Trump is such a capitalist, I don't understand why he wouldn't be in favor of trying to invest and make money on Cuba. And I'll take my answer up there.
David, thanks for the call. What do you think, William?
Well, you know, President Trump did try to invest in Cuba back in 1998 when it was strictly against the law because of the embargo. He sent a representative to Cuba to explore the possibility of opening a hotel there. And when they were questioned about it, they said, oh, they were on a humanitarian mission, which wasn't strictly true. But I think what's going on now is that President Trump, the politician, is making a political payoff to conservative Cuban Americans who supported him in the last election at a time when the vote in Florida looked like it was going to be very close.
Thanks for the call, David. William, there's this ongoing argument in both political theory and political practice. When you're looking at an oppressive regime, is it better to have trade and contact and that will loosen things up in that regime? Or is that trade reinforcing the regime, both through the money and maybe the prestige the company get or the country gets by having these contacts?
Well, I think you've got to look at on a case-by-case basis. In Cuba, we have a kind of natural experiment. We really did try every element of coercion against Cuba, from the Bay of Pigs invasion through the CIA's secret war against Cuba in the 1960s to very strict economic embargo, and then somewhat relaxed economic embargo. We tried getting the Latin America behind us, and for a while they subscribed to the embargo, and then they all got out of the embargo. We've tried a lot of different modalities of economic coercion to get Cuba to behave, and it has never worked. The only thing that's worked with Cuba over the years is sitting down with them, trying to find common interests, and negotiating with them based on mutual respect and respect for their sovereignty.
Now, President Trump has said President Obama made a bad deal. If he was going to do these things to loosen things up, he should have had specific commitments on human rights. Is there something to that?
Well, no. I think the president judged that the relaxation of particularly the regulations on the embargo were aimed at creating connections between Cuba and the United States, between not just the Cuban government and the U.S. government, but between U.S. business and Cuban business, between ordinary Americans and ordinary Cubans by loosening up travel regulations, in the belief that creating those connections would itself have a positive effect on change inside Cuba. That was the logic of what he did. To go to the Cuban government, for the U.S. government to go to the Cuban government and demand that they change their human rights practices or else has never worked. The Cuban government's response is always, that's a matter of our internal affairs. It's none of your business.
We'll leave it there for now. William, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to William Leo Grand. He's a professor of government at American University and a specialist in U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. He joined us to talk about President Trump's announcement on changing U.S. policy toward Cuba. The U.S. Open men's golf tournament got underway yesterday at the Erin Hills course northwest of Milwaukee. Tens of thousands of people are expected to attend the four-day contest. It's a boost for the golfing industry, which has seen only slow growth or some cutbacks over the last decade. A few courses in Wisconsin have even closed and become wildlife areas. Chuck Quirnbach went for a look.
A little west of Mequonago, there used to be two golf courses at the Rainbow Springs Resort. They were called Big Mo and Little Mo. A lodge built 50 years ago failed early on, but the quirky courses, a skull and crossbones flag flew at Big Mo's difficult 12th hole, stayed open until 2010. Then the Wisconsin DNR acquired the 970 acres, mainly using state stewardship dollars. The department tore down most of the old buildings. It also stopped using bug and weed killers and let the grass, weeds, and small trees grow to where this time of year the vegetation is waist high.
We're going to go up onto what was a tee box for the old golf course, and it'll give us a nice view.
Ann Corman walks onto what used to be Big Mo. She's the DNR's property manager here. Looking out at what used to be the first, 10th, and 18th holes, Corman sees good things.
This land is healing. In a healing stage, it was subjected to pesticides and herbicides for many years, and now it's not.
The absence of new chemicals is not only good for the land, it also benefits a high-quality water body that flows through Rainbow Springs, the Mequonago River. Corman says the sediments are cleaner now and there are more species of fish. Also, the river flows more naturally because most culverts have been removed. One more thing, Corman says it's now safer to canoe or kayak.
No longer have to worry about being hit by a golf ball when you're out here paddling.
The DNR is nearly done with its master plan for the area. After that, Corman hopes the agency budget will eventually allow for more planting of native species, a tearing down of the old golf clubhouse, and other improvements. But she says Rainbow Springs, or technically the Mequonago River Unit, will have to compete for dollars with a lot of other great state lands. The transformation to wildlife sanctuary is further along at another former golf course, a few miles north of Port Washington. Purple martins greet visitors near the parking lot of what used to be the Squires. For about a decade, the 116-acre site near Lake Michigan has been known as the Forest Beach Migratory Preserve. The nonprofit land owner, the Ozaukee Washington Land Trust, has built a two-story viewing stand. Executive Director Tom Stolp goes to the top.
So this is used by our visitors who are coming here to birdwatch.
Stolp says birders, including from the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory, based in the old Squires Pro Shop, have spotted about 250 species. He says the diversity is due to different habitats that were created.
Whereas a golf course probably has a more of a monoculture habitat, we have 8 different distinct habitats. There are 27 different wetlands across this property. The way we've been able to restore native vegetative species has meant that there's more bugs, more seeds from those plants. There's more food for the migrating birds.
Stolp says the Land Trust plans to improve the preserve by planting more native species and trying to get rid of invasives. He says he's not against golf and that there are still plenty of fine courses in the area. That includes the challenging layout the pros are playing this week at Erin Hills, where birdies may be hard to come by. Chuck Quirnbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.